It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we find out about the long and varied history of African Americans in northeastern Wisconsin.
First, the 104th Tour de France began on Saturday. The 3,540-kilometer, or 2,220-mile route, started in Dusseldorf, Germany, and wound its way through Belgium and Luxembourg before entering France today. The grueling race will end on Sunday, July 23rd, on Paris's iconic Champs-Élysées.
While the modern competitors certainly have their share of challenges, in many ways they pale in comparison to what the riders in the first tour in 1903 faced, including horrible road conditions, oppressive heat, and small numbers of spectators.
Peter Cossens has chronicled that inaugural race in his new book, The First Tour de France, 60 Cyclists and 19 Days of Daring on the Road to Paris. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
So set the stage for us. What was going on in France in the late 19th century?
It was, from a political and social point of view, France was, you could argue, it was the center of everything. The Belle Epoque was in full swing. Paris was probably the most important city in the world, lots of innovation in all kinds of fields.
A little earlier than that, France had suffered what was considered a pretty humiliating defeat to Germany in the Franco-Prussian War, and they lost two of their eastern provinces. And so how did that play into the French psyche at this point?
Well, it's interesting. It kind of colored everything that was going on in the country. I mean, the French, like you say, they'd lost Alsace and Lorraine in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. They'd suffered a devastating defeat. And one of the key things about sport during that period in France was that it was used very much as a tool for promoting French manhood, or trying to promote French manhood, virility, the idea of France as a nation state being a strong power. And so when you had events like the Tour de France being established in 1903, and even before that, they would the press would talk up the racers, the competitors, as almost like heroes, as an example, I suppose, of what could be achieved if you applied yourself, if you pushed yourself really hard, if you were really committed to something. And it was really sort of promoting this idea that the French could be strong. And in everybody's mind, there was this idea of we need to hold back the Germans, basically. We need to be ready. We need to be fit. We need to be prepared.
While today we think of bicycles as very common and quite affordable, at what point did they become popularized in France and in Europe?
From about the mid-1890s, I mean, before that, cycling was very much an elite sport, so a bike might cost 500 francs, which, if you bear in mind that labourer would probably, in the early 1890s, probably earns about 2 francs a day. I mean, you're talking almost like a year's salary.
Wow.
But by the end of that decade, the price of a bicycle had come down to about 100 francs. The wages had gone up to about 5 francs a day, so it was like 20 days' salary. And people were using bikes quite a lot to get about, and they were also being used a lot within business. So for delivery boys in Paris and other big cities were using bikes. So it was becoming something that was a mode of transport that was very popular. It was replacing the horse and cart. By the end of the 1890s, I think there were in the region of 1.5 to 2 million bikes in use in France. I mean, the figures are very precise because every bike was taxed at that point as well.
Oh, interesting. So the bikes of today's tour competitors, of course, are amazingly designed and engineered. What were the bikes like then?
They were a step up, I guess. I mean, initially, they were racing on penny farthings or ordinaries, where people would remember that you have like a huge front wheel and a very small rear wheel. In the mid-1880s, they started to have what they call a safety bicycle, which was like the design that essentially we've still got today. But by the time the Tour came along, 1903, their bikes were still extremely heavy, so they probably weighed 30 pounds, some of them. They had wooden rims. They had no brakes. They just had one gear, so if you were going up a hill, you either got off and pushed, or you just struggled along.
We're talking with Peter Cossens. His new book is The First Tour de France, 60 Cyclists and 19 Days of Daring on the Road to Paris. Well, it would be a fair guess, I think, to assume that the first Tour de France in 1903 came out of a deep love for the sport and a desire to highlight the stars. There was that, but founder Henri Desgange was on a much more mundane and personal mission, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was the editor-in-chief of a newspaper called Loto, which translates as the car. It had been known as Loto Velo before, cars and bikes, but they were in a bitter circulation war with another newspaper called Le Velo, the bicycle, and Desgange was losing that war. His publication was on the verge of going out of business, and he was looking for ways to boost circulation. And newspapers, Desgange is among them at that stage. They knew that they could put on big sporting events, and they would draw a crowd, and it would push up circulation. But it was just it kind of gave them a temporary lift, and then it would fall back down again. Bear in mind, at that point, nobody had ever thought of running a stage race. There were lots of one-day races, but nobody had ever thought of running a race from one point to another and then to another point beyond that and just keeping it going, which is how we think of most races today. Desgange was in a meeting in late 1902 with one of his subordinates, Gilles Lefebvre, and Lefebvre came up with this idea of he drew out the map of France, the story has it, on a napkin in front of them and sort of put in the main cities and said, look, we could join all these up and run a race between all six of these major cities and keep the race going for several days. And that's basically, that's where the idea sprung from. They needed to kind of keep that interest. They needed to boost their circulation.
Well, and because bicycling had been really a track sport before, people really couldn't watch it unless they were going to those specially designed tracks, which I'm guessing were mostly in big cities. What did it mean for residents of small French villages to have a major race coming through their towns?
Well, it's interesting because on the day that the tour started, which was the 1st of July 1903, the race started just on the edge of Paris, and there was a very feeble turnout, I suppose you'd say, describe it, that they were expecting a lot of people to come, but, I mean, Paris is a huge city. There was lots of events competing for everybody's interest. So nobody really got that excited about a bike race taking place. And when Desgange went back to his office in central Paris after the riders had set off, he kind of thought, well, this is going to be a failure. We're going to go out of business here. But his assistant, Lefebvre, who was following the race, he realized pretty quickly, because they were riding to Lyon on that first stage, which was 300 miles away, he realized by the time they'd covered 100 miles and gone through the first two or three smallish towns that thousands and thousands of people were turning out to see this race. They'd never seen anything like this. They'd never seen top-class sport. They'd never seen any kind of big event like this at all. And that's how it continued over the next few days. It really captivated the public's attention outside Paris, to the extent that by the time they did actually get back to Paris after 3 weeks of racing, everybody in Paris was gripped by it as well, because they'd seen this huge story unfolding, they'd seen the excitement at the side of the road, they'd read about it in the papers anyway, and so everybody in Paris by then wanted to see it as well.
And Peter, as we wrap up, how do you think that the Tour de France has managed to stay so popular now for more than a century?
There are lots of different elements to that. I mean, I think two of the key things about the Tour, which must be remembered, is it's a fantastic race, it's a fantastic event, but also it's a massive marketing tool. I mean, it's as much a marketing tool as it is a race, I believe. And the thing that it markets more than anything is France as a nation. It goes into every corner of France. The people all over France still love it. I mean, especially in these little towns and villages in the remote areas of what they call La France Profonde, deepest France. They know that the tour is going to come there every 5 or 6 years, and even now it might be the only thing that happens every 5 or 6 years. And everybody's still gripped to it. And, of course, now it's got this real international aspect to it. We see lots of English-speaking riders and Russians and riders from Asia and all over the world now taking part. And they're drawing in crowds from those areas. So you not only have the French fans at the side of the road, you have this huge international audience as well.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Peter Cassens is the author of a new book titled The First Tour de France, 60 Cyclists and 19 Days of Daring on the Road to Paris. He joined us to share what that first race was like as the 104th edition of the competition is happening now.
When we think of African Americans in the 19th century in this country, it is often slavery in the South or life in large industrial cities that comes to mind. But in fact, African Americans lived all over, including here in Wisconsin.
Victoria Toshin teaches African history and women's and gender studies at St. Norbert College in De Pere, Wisconsin. And she's researched the history of African Americans in northeastern Wisconsin. Victoria, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
What brought African Americans to northeast Wisconsin in the first place?
Well, actually, it's important to recognize the deep roots of an African American presence in what eventually becomes Wisconsin. People of African descent came into the upper Midwest with French fur traders as far back as the 1600s, and I think the earliest documented case of a person of African descent in what becomes Wisconsin dates to 1725 in Green Bay. African Americans were independently involved in the fur trade also. For example, the first non-native settlers of what becomes Marinette were two African American men, fur traders, who settled there in the 1790s. Other African Americans came to Wisconsin as enslaved people, brought there by those who owned them, though these were relatively few in number and mainly in the southwestern part of the state in the lead region. Fugitive slaves and free African Americans came to Wisconsin also, people who wanted to leave the South or free states other than Wisconsin in hopes of a better life. We have people, African Americans, arriving here from virtually all of the southern states, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, other Midwestern states. So it was really a phenomenon of people moving here from many different parts of the country.
So it sounds like at least in those early years there were one or two African American settlers here and there. When did we first see a significant African-American community develop in northeastern Wisconsin?
Well, the numbers grow slowly but steadily over the second half of the 19th century. And in northeast Wisconsin, African-American populations typically peaked around 1890. There is variation from county to county, but it is this process of slow but steady growth. In 1870, Fond du Lac had the largest African-American population of any city in Wisconsin, with 179 African-American residents. There were also significant 19th-century African-American populations in Green Bay, Oshkosh, Appleton. But the reality is that African-Americans also lived scattered broadly across the rural parts of northeast Wisconsin, too. For example, in Brown County in 1870, African Americans lived in De Pere and Fort Howard and Lawrence and Preble and Wrightstown, and in 1880, Bellevue. In Winnebago County in 1870, African Americans lived in Menasha and Rushford and Utica and Winneconne, as well as Oshkosh. In fact, one African American man in Rushford owned a farm valued at $3,000 in 1870, and a man in Menasha owned one valued at $3,500. In the 1850s, there were African Americans living on Washington Island off the tip of Door County. So the population was really widely dispersed.
So even with that wide dispersal of African Americans living in the state and focusing on the northeastern part of the state, what was kind of the glue that held those communities together?
Well, there was an African American church in Fond du Lac that dates to shortly after the middle of the 19th century, and that existed for some decades. So that was one focal point. I've come across newspaper accounts of gatherings of 300 and more African Americans, you know, in a park in northeast Wisconsin, socializing together, having essentially a picnic and a get-together. So that those kinds of things certainly happened.
We're talking with Victoria Toshin, who teaches African history and women's and gender studies at St. Norbert College in De Pere, Wisconsin. And we're talking about her research into the history of African Americans in northeastern Wisconsin. So these African Americans, you said that there were some that were farming and actually farming some pretty significant amounts of land. What other kinds of work were those African Americans doing in northeastern Wisconsin?
Well, there was an informal color bar that steered disproportionate numbers of African American men into typically low-paying and low-status jobs, working as day laborers, janitors, porters, farm workers, street cleaners, shoe shining, factory work, and this informal color bar also steered women into domestic work as maids, servants, laundresses, cooks, and things like that. So the color bar was absolutely real and limited African Americans' income in many cases because it did steer African American people into low-income jobs. But that color bar did not ensnare everyone. The examples of the farmers I just mentioned would be one exception. And there was a man named Bird Parker who lived in Oshkosh in the 1850s. He came there from Chicago, and he came to Oshkosh because he had been hired by Frederick Douglass, the noted abolitionist, to be the Wisconsin and Minnesota distributor of Douglass's newspaper, and he decided to base himself out of Oshkosh to do that work as a traveling agent. He also championed abolitionism in public talks throughout the state, and Bird Parker was said to be as good an orator as Douglass in some newspaper accounts. He also owned a restaurant in Oshkosh, and he owned six lots of property, contiguous property in Oshkosh, so he was another individual who escaped the color bar. Some people were entrepreneurs. If you were to go to Chilton on the east side of Lake Winnebago, its first non-native settler was an African-American man, Moses Stanton, who came there in 1845 and built both a sawmill and a gristmill there. In fact, Chilton was previously named Stantonville in honor of Moses Stanton. The name was later changed in the 1850s. There were dozens and dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of African-American men who worked as barbers in northeast Wisconsin in the 19th century. And if they were entrepreneurs and owned their own business, they might become substantially wealthy.
How were African-Americans received in the predominantly white northeastern Wisconsin communities to which they came?
Well, the reaction of Wisconsinites was certainly mixed. On the plus side, Wisconsin did not enact the so-called black laws, which were designed to keep African Americans out, as did many other Midwestern states. So no black laws here. Local data, for example, shows African American children consistently attending public schools in the 19th century, and Wisconsin, in fact, was the only Midwestern state that did not have segregation in its public school system. So this was presumably a draw to some African Americans who came to Wisconsin. There are some interesting examples of acceptance in local communities. A man named Peter Pendleton settled in what became Nina. He arrived either in the late 20s or early 30s, and he voted in the first town meeting ever held in Nina in 1847. Interestingly, among a host of votes for things like tax assessment and town officials, there was a vote on whether or not to grant what was called colored suffrage. 34 votes were in favor, 13 against. Peter Pendleton would have had to live knowing, you know, that about a quarter of his neighbors did not support his right to vote. But he was allowed to vote, even though this was before African-American men got to vote in Wisconsin. His son continued that tradition, voting in Outagamie County, also before African-Americans got the vote here in 1866. On the negative side, his son's vote sparked an outcry among white residents of Outagamie County who were appalled that he had been allowed to vote. The vote was upheld, but there was community pushback for sure. We have things going on here like interracial marriages, which were quite common, receiving often sensationalist and racist newspaper coverage.
So certainly northeastern Wisconsin was predominantly white, but there was and is a significant Native American population. How much did the African American and Native American populations mix or live together?
There was a lot of mixing between those two communities, lots of intermarriages between people with African American and Native American ancestry, and that's a phenomenon that has been widespread throughout the history of what becomes the United States going back to the colonial era. In Calumet County, where many Native Americans settled, there were a lot of families that had mixed Native American and African American ancestry. In De Pere, an African American man named Henry Sink settled and bought a home and married two women who, after the first wife died, who were Native American, and he hosted the weddings of a lot of area Native Americans at his private home. So there was a lot of interaction between those two communities.
And Victoria, before we wrap up, you mentioned that the African American population in northeastern Wisconsin really peaked at the end of the 19th century. What happened after that? Why was there a decline?
Well, positive things can draw you elsewhere for good reasons, and negative things can push you elsewhere for, you know, unfortunate reasons. And I think both operated in northeast Wisconsin in the early 20th century. But the late 19th and early 20th centuries were a time of radically worsening race relationships across the United States when there was a profound backlash against the gains being made by African Americans after emancipation and in the Reconstruction era. And northeast Wisconsin was not immune to this national phenomenon. With the dawning of the 20th century, African Americans in northeast Wisconsin faced increased police harassment, increased discrimination in employment, increased discrimination in housing, and with this, African Americans leave here in really completely disproportionate numbers when you look at the white population. Perhaps reflective of this increased racism is the fact that the Klan had a brief heyday in the Fox River Valley in the mid-20s. It was very active in Oshkosh and Fond du Lac and Appleton. Cross burnings occurred in all of those communities, in De Pere, in Green Bay, in Sturgeon Bay. And this is actually after African Americans leave here in large numbers, but of course the knowledge that the Klan was a deeply racist organization was widely known. It was widely written about in area newspapers. There is also the creation at this time of what are known as sundown towns, towns in which African Americans are not welcome after dark. Often their labor was desired and welcome, so they were allowed to be in these communities in the day. But they faced threats of serious violence, which was carried out often if they did not leave. And so we also see the development of restrictive covenants in northeast Wisconsin. One in a new De Pere subdivision said that no persons of any race other than Gentiles of the Caucasian race shall use or occupy any building unless you are a domestic servant living mm-hmm. with a white family. So these sometimes targeted Jews as well as African Americans. I found them in other area communities as well.
And we'll have to leave it there. Victoria, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Victoria Toshin teaches African history and women's and gender studies at St. Norbert College in De Pere. She joined us to discuss the history of African Americans in northeast Wisconsin. Are girls taking over the world? Girls are said to outperform boys on exams. They're more likely to start and finish college. A pair of researchers in Canada interviewed 57 of the so-called supergirls to find out what their lives are like as they strive for straight A's. And do they think they still need a leg up in a male-dominated world?
Shauna Pomerantz joins us. She's an associate professor of child and youth studies at Brock University in Ontario, Canada. She co-authored the new book, Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism. Shauna, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
You spent a lot of time with these smart girls. What are they like? Who are they?
Well, they come from all different walks of life. They are most certainly working very, very hard. One of the things we learned about these smart girls is that they are not afraid to call themselves smart, at least to researchers, but out there in school, they're a little bit more protective about their smart identity. So they engage in all sorts of negotiation tactics to kind of downplay their intelligence in order to get along in the schools.
How hard are they working?
They're working so hard that some of them talked about not really getting much sleep at night, sacrificing social lives. Girls were very, very concerned to do well, but they were also concerned that they had to do well at multiple things. So it wasn't just that they were smart. The Supergirl drive for success that we talk about in one of the chapters points to this idea that they had to be well-rounded. You know, they had to do well in extracurricular activities. They had to be part of school politics. They had to be fit, and they had to be also, you know, well-dressed and well-mannered.
What are the trade-offs for these girls? What are they sacrificing to maintain this extreme form of perfection in their lives?
Well, the girls we talked to weren't always into perfection, but there were certainly a small group of them who were very invested in doing everything well, the girls I just spoke about, who might fit this so-called supergirl stereotype. But one of the things we really found is that the girls were not so much sacrificing as they were struggling in ways that seemed to be made invisible by very, very dominant media accounts of how well girls are doing today. So we talk about girls doing very well, now we need to pay attention to boys, but at the same time, we learned that girls are struggling with sexism. They're struggling with racism. They're struggling to maintain some of that perfection that I talked about. And so the book is really about trying to spotlight all the ways that girls are still struggling in spite of this idea that girls are doing very, very well in school.
Some of the adjectives that came up a lot, I found in your book, describe these smart girls in this way: ambitious, confident, optimistic. I read about passionate, thoroughly dedicated to school. What could possibly be going wrong here?
I know, it's a great question. And I think the media headlines today, and we've been seeing this for about 20 years now, suggest that girls are just fine. And now we really should be turning our attention to boys. And this has been a very, very popular discussion around gender and education easily since the early 90s. What's going wrong, I think, is that girls have left the agenda. They're no longer being focused on in the way they used to be in the 70s and 80s when feminists were working to kind of bring girls up to par with boys in the education system. And now girls are struggling to maintain not just perfection and not just high grades, but they're also struggling to sort out what's happening to them when they are being faced with sexism in the school, when a teacher is treating girls and boys differently, or when the boys in the school are talking to them about making them sandwiches, when the girls feel that they have to dumb down in order to be seen as hot or dateable or desirable by the boys. And so when I say stuff is happening, it's all very much below the surface of these bright futures and these straight A's that the girls are achieving.
We're talking with Shauna Pomerantz. She's the a co-author of the new book, Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism. Shauna, you interviewed 17 boys who identified themselves as being smart. How has the success of boys changed with the rise of these girls who are really keyed in on academic performance?
Mm-hmm. Well, boys have always done well and girls have always done well. It's not that boys do well at one time and then girls do well at the other times. Some boys do great, some girls do great. The problem is that we tend to talk about it in these very stark binary terms, boys versus girls. We don't usually bring in issues of race or class, which really complicate the picture of academic success. So when I say boys do great, I can say that middle-class white boys tend to do better than working-class black boys, for example, or other configurations that might really impact that. So I think that boys and girls, you know, sort of struggle along, but in very different ways. Boys tend to use humor. They tend to engage in class clown sort of personas in order to downplay their academic success so that they can still be popular in school. But the girls talked about dumbing down in a way that boys never, ever did. The boys simply didn't feel that they had to hide being smart, but they did feel that they had to downplay studying, whereas the girls felt that they sometimes had to downplay actually being intelligent.
A new report just came out in the journal Science. It's found that girls as young as age 6 perceive themselves to be less smart than boys. Are we a lot further away from gender equity than we think?
We sure are. That's certainly one of the things that we discovered in our own research. And I know that study, it's a very good study because it suggests that we might be thinking of girls as having reached gender equity, and we certainly talk that way. In the book, we frame it as a post-feminist narrative where we tend to think of girls as past the need for any attention at all. But when you read that study in Science, you realize that actually girls as young as 6 or younger are thinking of themselves as lesser than boys and men and as not being able to achieve the kind of success that boys and men achieve. And that's what we found in our study as well. Girls were working very, very hard, but they also felt that they had to work even harder than boys did to achieve a similar kind of success. So it wasn't so much disheartening as it was enlightening to see that we really do need to refocus our attention in education. We're not anywhere near as far as we thought on gender equity.
Where do we see these notions at such a young age coming from? I mean, where are these young girls getting this idea that they're not on par with their boy counterparts?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. I suppose we could point to media, as people do, and we could say that in popular culture we get Representations of girls and boys doing really different things. You know, boys tend to be active in cartoons, in movies geared toward children. They tend to be superheroes. They tend to fight. They tend to solve problems. They tend to build. Whereas girls are seen much more socially. They tend to communicate and relate. They're seen more in the sphere of friendship and family as opposed to in that active world and in the outside world, too. And so I think that's one place we can look. But, you know, it's such a pervasive issue, and that study really put a spotlight on the fact that perhaps we're not doing as good a job as we think in the school system talking to boys and girls in similar ways. We do tend to see girls as pretty and cute, and we do tend to see boys as tough and rugged and sort of ingenious and industrious. And so those words alone set up the entire discussion about how young people see themselves.
When you interviewed over quite a while these 57 teenagers, most of them teenagers, mm-hmm. you broke down their situations by race, by home life, by their socioeconomic background. How do all of these different things factor into the formula for a smart girl?
Mm-hmm. Well, race was particularly interesting. The girls we interviewed in the Canadian context spoke a great deal about the smart Asian stereotype, which I know is prevalent in the United States as well. And it's the idea that Asian girls are simply smart by definition of their race. And so we talked to girls from various Asian cultures and backgrounds, and they had these really very, you know, interesting stories to tell about the fact that they're just not good at math. And that everyone assumed that they would be. And when it turned out that they couldn't do homework for their friends, they became very disappointing, you know, sort of a traitor in a number of senses. And so race was salient because sometimes we think of certain races as being smarter than other races. And sometimes we think of certain races as being, you know, less smart. And around the issue of class, what we found is that the girls who really were able to achieve the highest level of that supergirl perfection I talked about earlier did tend to come from, although not always, but they tended to come from middle-class or upper-middle-class backgrounds with professional parents who really had the time and skills to devote to not just talking to them about the meaning of education, but getting them the help that they need vis-a-vis tutoring or, you know, extracurricular activities. All of those things cost money. And so a number of girls in the study who came from working class or working poor backgrounds, they felt that they had to work just a little bit harder to get that edge that middle class girls had.
We're talking about the rise of the supergirl and how girls negotiate this drive for academic success and what it means for boys. Shauna Pomerantz is with us. Her new book is Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism.
We'd like to hear your thoughts on how girls are doing over on the Central Time Facebook page. Is it cool to be smart? Have girls reached gender parity with boys? Should we stop teaching girls about feminism and let them advocate for themselves on their own? And are boys being left behind? Post your thoughts about smart girls and see what others have to say over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about supergirls, the teenage girls who strive for perfection in their schoolwork, and what happens when it transfers over into the rest of their lives. Girls are entering college and graduating at a higher rate than boys, but is this success coming with a cost?
What do you think? Are girls putting too much pressure on themselves to get ahead? Do you think we've achieved gender parity? And what about the boys in the classroom? Do you think it's now boys who are being left behind? Share what you're thinking over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right now, we're continuing the conversation with Youth Studies Professor Shauna Pomerantz. She's co-author of the new book, Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism. Shauna, you asked the teenage girls about feminism and what it means to them. What did they tell you about feminism?
Oh, well, they had a lot of different things to say, but I would say overall they were somewhat distancing from the idea of being feminist. What we found so interesting is that the girls all say very feminist things. You know, they don't want to be put down by boys. They don't want to be objectified. They don't want to be taken for granted. And they aspire to such great success in their careers. But at the same time, if you ask them, are you a feminist or do you believe that feminist politics are necessary, they will often say, no, they're not feminist. And so we struggled sometimes in interviews to help them possibly see that they were, in fact, engaging with feminism without even really knowing that they were doing it.
What does this post-feminist world then look like?
Well, the culture is post-feminist, but I don't know that all girls are. I mean, the culture is post-feminist because in media and popular culture representations in the news, there's endless stories that suggest that girls are equal to boys, that girls are even superior to boys, and that's what this discourse in education is all about. Not only are girls seen as doing just as well as boys, but now they're seen as doing better, leaving boys in the dust. And so part of the book is about explaining that, well, that may be what it looks like on paper, it's not really what it looks like in practice. We analyzed some statistics of CEOs and government and, you know, various institutions, and we find that men still hold the power in the majority of those situations. So while girls may be doing well in school, they're not necessarily rising up and, you know, taking the power that people think they're taking in the broader world.
Let's take a call now with Jane from Oconto. Hi, Jane.
Yes. I think my daughter would qualify as one of those super girls. She can't call right now because she's working as a physician's assistant. She also volunteers one afternoon a week, and she's carrying a full load in the honors track at Drake. And her first semester, she made Dean's List. She's been on the president's list ever since. And I think she would say that it is not helpful to constantly be comparing. The point is to encourage everyone to treat people as individuals, acknowledge their efforts and their work.
Jane, did she have this drive from a very young age? When did you see this in her?
Well, she had a 4.0 in high school. She has a very good older siblings. She has a sister who's working on her doctorate in psychology, a brother who's graduating with a master's in music, and she is probably the most driven and the most organized of the three.
Shauna?
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like she comes from a very high-achieving family. Would you say that's the case, Jane?
I think so. They all know that they have to work hard to get where they want to be. And I think when students and people start seeing each other as colleagues without the dismissive gender labels, I think they get further. I think you're right that they're still high-achieving women often are not taken as seriously as their male counterparts, but I don't think saying, oh, boys have been preferred, now girls should be preferred, girls should be, boys should be preferred, isn't helping the matters any.
It's not helping at all. As a matter of fact, one of the main points of the book is to really move outside of that really narrow discussion. We kind of chronicle the boys versus girls debate, and as I said, it's been going on easily for 20 years now in both the United States, Canada, and overseas too, in the UK, Australia, New Zealand. We have similar, you know, common sense thinking. So one of the main points of the book isn't to put girls ahead of boys or to show how girls are suffering more than boys, but really to suggest that the idea of gender as this divisive category is not useful. Girls are struggling in ways that are made invisible by these very, very stark categorizations. We'd like to make visible the struggles of all kids. And so we happen to focus on girls in the book because there seems to be a particular bent right now towards suggesting that girls are just fine, as I said, this post-feminist culture. And we wanted to expose that as an absolute myth. We're not in a post-feminist world. Girls need feminism now just as much, if not more, than they ever have. And so, Jane, I agree with you that these dismissive gender labels are not useful.
Jane, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Jessica in New Berlin. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
What would you like to add?
I guess I would like to add that I didn't feel the need to dumb myself down when I was in grade school or high school or college, but I did see that in my peers. I didn't see it in my, like, I went to a very, very small school, so I had, like, 8 kids in my class, and I had other very smart girls around me, so it was very cool to be smart in my class, but I did see it with the girls that I had extracurricular activities with. They went to public school, and they had to, it seemed like it wasn't as cool to be smart where they went to school.
Shauna?
Jessica, first of all, thanks for calling. It's great to get some firsthand experience. One of the things we found in our research, and we've written about this in the book, is that the school the girls went to really, really made a difference. So it sounds like you went to a school where it was cool to be smart, you know, 8 kids in the class. I'm sure academic success was considered really important and a huge part of school culture. But there are other schools, and we talked to girls from about 15 different schools across Ontario. Other schools didn't have a cool to be smart attitude. In fact, it was just the opposite. It was more of a cheerleading culture. Girls felt that they had to balance their academic success with being, you know, hot, thin, pretty. And so I suppose it really depends on the school you go to. One of the things we talk about at the end of the book is that a school culture really makes or breaks how a girl feels about her academic success. And so I think you are very lucky to have gone to a school where that was considered a cool thing to be.
And, Shauna, you conclude in your book that it is cool to be a smart girl, just like Jessica made her comment about it was cool to be a girl in her class. But what is the alternative? Girls who want to live a fulfilling life have really no choice but to really go after it and succeed.
Yes, I mean, the alternative is not as glamorous or as successful. You either go for it or you don't. But we didn't talk to girls who didn't call themselves smart, but our feeling is that there's a large group of girls out there being ignored because, of course, they're not doing as well as some of the more talked about girls are doing. And those girls need attention, too. We don't want girls falling through the cracks. We don't want boys falling through the cracks. So I wouldn't say that all girls felt that they had to succeed. I would say some girls felt more driven than others. Some girls had the home life privilege and the class-based privilege to really get that edge, as I mentioned earlier. And other girls were really in the middle. You know, they were just kind of getting along and getting sort of C's and B's. Not every girl gets straight A's, which is contrary to what is sort of the popular discussion out there today.
Thank you, Jessica, for your call. Let's now go to Brittany in Madison. Hi, Brittany.
Hello. I just wanted to add that I was a smart girl. Still am, but I got severely bullied because of it. I didn't have friends for a lot of years. There's a lot of things in life I could have learned, you know, if I didn't have that. I think the socioeconomic differences in schools is very prevalent. I moved from a not-so-good school outside of Detroit to a really very nice school in New Berlin and was able to become much more successful than I would have.
I'm going to have to jump in here. Shauna, very quickly, what about the situation with Brittany being bullied for being a smart girl?
Not uncommon, Brittany, and thanks for sharing your story. We heard from girls that they were sometimes teased. We didn't hear extreme cases of bullying, but this is why girls felt the need to dumb down. They just didn't always feel that it meshed with being either cool or popular or even just accepted at school.
Shauna, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Shauna Pomeranz, co-author of the book Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism. She joined us to talk about her research and how girls deal with their academic superiority and what barriers they still face today.
Natural slime has been around for eons, but the commercial version has been around since Mattel started selling it in small plastic garbage cans in the late 1970s.
And since then, Bill Murray and the other original Ghostbusters got nailed with it, and Nickelodeon guests have gotten green slime dumped on them.
But now, a cottage industry of slime has developed, and it's often the work of young entrepreneurs.
The standard slime ingredients are white school glue and the household cleaning detergent known as borax or sodium borate. But then the sky's the limit with add-ins like glitter, food coloring, and even essential oils. It's really artisanal slime.
Well, if you're thinking of trying your hand at it, fifth grader and slime entrepreneur Goldie Bronson says the sound it makes is key. It should make crackling sounds when it's poked.
If you think you have what it takes to produce high-quality slime, there's a useful video over on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Sasson, bringing you valuable life hacks. This is Central Time.